Life is complex. Join us for the simple gifts of wisdom, love, and delight in the written word. The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Part 2 on the Man Called Christ. Chapter 5, The Escape from Paganism. Part 2. Asia is all humanity, as it has worked out its human doom. Asia, in its vast territory, in its varied populations, in its heights of past achievement and its depths of dark speculation, is itself a world and represents something of what we mean when we speak of the world. It is a cosmos rather than a continent. It is the world as man has made it, and contains many of the most wonderful things that man has made. Therefore, Asia stands as the one representative of paganism and the one rival to Christendom. But everywhere else where we get glimpses of that moral destiny, they suggest stages in the same story. Where Asia trails away into the southern archipelagos of the savages, or where a darkness full of nameless shapes dwells in the heart of Africa, or where the last survivors of lost races linger in the cold volcano of prehistoric America, it is all the same story. Sometimes, perhaps, later chapters of the same story. It is men entangled in the forest of their own mythology. It is men drowned in the sea of their own metaphysics. Polytheists have grown weary of the wildest of fictions. Monotheists have grown weary of the most wonderful of truths. Diabolists here and there have such a hatred of heaven and earth that they have tried to take refuge in hell. It is the fall of man. And it is exactly that fall that was being felt by our own fathers at the first moment of the Roman decline. We also were going down that wide road, down that easy slope, following the magnificent procession of the high civilizations of the world. If the church had not entered the world then, it seems probable that Europe would be now very much what Asia is now. Something may be allowed for a real difference of race and environment, visible in the ancient as in the modern world. But after all, we talk about the changeless East very largely because it has not suffered the great change. Paganism, in its last phase, showed considerable signs of becoming equally changeless. This would not mean that new schools or sects of philosophy would not arise, as new schools did arise in antiquity and do arise in Asia. It does not mean that there would be no real mystics or visionaries, as there were mystics in antiquity and are mystics in Asia. It does not mean that there would be no social codes, as there were social codes in antiquity and are codes in Asia. It does not mean that there could not be good men or happy lives, for God has given all men a conscience, and conscience can give all men a kind of peace. But it does mean that the tone and proportion of all these things, and especially the proportion of good and evil things, would be in the unchanged West what they are in the changeless East. And nobody who looks at that changeless East honestly and with a real sympathy can believe that there is anything there remotely resembling the challenge and revolution of the faith. In short, if classic paganism had lingered until now, a number of things might well have lingered with it, and they would look very like what we call the religions of the East. There would still be Pythagoreans teaching reincarnation, as there are still Hindus teaching reincarnation. There would still be Stoics making a religion out of reason and virtue, as there are still Confucians making a religion out of reason and virtue. There would still be Neoplatonists studying transcendental truths, the meaning of which was mysterious to other people and disputed even amongst themselves. As the Buddhists still study, a transcendentalism mysterious to others and disputed among themselves. There would still be intelligent Apollonians apparently worshipping the sun god, but explaining that they were worshipping the divine principle. Just as there are still intelligent Parsis apparently worshipping the sun, but explaining that they are worshipping the deity. There would still be wild Dionysians dancing on the mountains, as there are still wild dervishes dancing in the desert. There would still be crowds of people attending the popular feasts of the gods in pagan Europe, as in pagan Asia. There would still be crowds of gods, local and other, for them to worship. And there would still be a great many more people who worshipped them than people who believed in them. Finally, there would still be a very large number of people who did worship gods and did believe in gods, and who believed in gods and worshipped gods simply because they were demons. There would still be Levantines secretly sacrificing to Moloch, as there are still thugs secretly sacrificing to Kali. There would still be a great deal of magic, and a great deal of it would be black magic. There would still be a considerable admiration of Seneca and a considerable imitation of Nero. Just as the exalted epigrams of Confucius could coexist with the tortures of China. And over all that tangled forest of traditions, growing wild or withering, would brood the broad silence of a singular and even nameless mood. But the nearest name of it is nothing. All these things, good and bad, would have an indescribable air of being too old to die. None of these things occupying Europe in the absence of Christendom would bear the least likeness to Christendom. Since the Pythagorean metempsychosis would still be there, we might call it the Pythagorean religion, as we talk about the Buddhist religion. As the noble maxims of Socrates would still be there, we might call it the Socratic religion, as we talk about the Confucian religion. As the popular holiday was still marked by a mythological hymn to Adonis, we might call it the religion of Adonis, as we talk about the religion of Juggernaut. As literature would still be based on the Greek mythology, we might call that mythology a religion, as we call the Hindu mythology a religion. We might say that there were so many thousands or millions of people belonging to that religion, in the sense of frequenting such temples, or merely living in a land full of such temples. But if we called the last tradition of Pythagoras, or the lingering legend of Adonis, by the name of a religion, then we must find some other name for the Church of Christ. If anybody says that philosophic maxims preserved through many ages, or mythological temples frequented by many people, are things of the same class and category as the church, it is enough to answer quite simply that they are not. Nobody thinks they are the same when he sees them in the old civilization of Greece and Rome. Nobody would think they were the same if that civilization had lasted 2,000 years longer and existed at the present day. Nobody can in reason think they are the same in the parallel pagan civilization in the East as it is at the present day. None of these philosophies or mythologies are anything like a church. Certainly nothing like a church militant. And, as I have shown elsewhere, even if this rule were not already proved, the exception would prove the rule. The rule is that pre-Christian or pagan history does not produce a church militant. and the exception, or what some would call the exception, is that Islam is at least militant, if it is not church. And that is precisely because Islam is the one religious rival that is not pre-Christian, and therefore not in that sense pagan. Islam was a product of Christianity, even if it was a byproduct, even if it was a bad product. It was a heresy or parody, emulating and therefore imitating the church. It is no more surprising that Mohammedanism had something of her fighting spirit than that Quakerism had something of her peaceful spirit. After Christianity, there are any number of such emulations or extensions. Before it, there are none. The church militant is thus unique because it is an army marching to effect a universal deliverance. The bondage from which the world is thus to be delivered is something that is very well symbolized by the state of Asia as by the state of pagan Europe. I do not mean merely their moral or immoral state. The missionary, as a matter of fact, has much more to say for himself than the enlightened imagine, even when he says that the heathen are idolatrous and immoral. A touch or two of realistic experience about Eastern religion, even about Muslim religion, will reveal some startling insensibilities in ethics, such as the practical indifference to the line between passion and perversion. It is not prejudice, but practical experience which says that Asia is full of demons as well as gods. But the evil I mean is in the mind. And it is in the mind wherever the mind has worked for a long time alone. It is what happens when all dreaming and thinking have come to an end in an emptiness that is at once negation and necessity. It sounds like an anarchy, but it is also a slavery. It is what has been called already the wheel of Asia. All those recurrent arguments about cause and effect, or things beginning and ending in the mind, which make it impossible for the soul really to strike out and go anywhere or do anything. And the point is that it is not necessarily peculiar to Asiatics. It would have been true in the end of Europeans if something had not happened. If the church militant had not been a thing marching, all men would have been marking time. If the church militant had not endured a discipline, all men would have endured a slavery. What that universal yet fighting faith brought into the world was hope. Perhaps the one thing common to mythology and philosophy was that both were really sad, in the sense that they had not this hope even if they had touches of faith or charity. We may call Buddhism a faith, though to us it seems more like a doubt. We may call the Lord of Compassion a Lord of Charity, though it seems to us a very pessimist sort of pity. But those who insist most on the antiquity and size of such cults must agree that in all their ages, they have not covered all their areas with that sort of practical and pugnacious hope.
'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we will not be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right.